Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've got a show today that's data-driven, inflation and incomes, plus electric cars. To quote every car salesman ever, what would it take for you to drive one home today? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, September 17th. It's great to have you with us. We got a lot of new data today from the U.S. government. We're going to start with inflation, basically how much things like food and gas actually cost. Well, numbers out today say inflation is creeping up, but don't be alarmed. Inflation is still below the Federal Reserve's target of 2% a year. The Fed is meeting now, and inflation is at the top of its agenda. Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
By buying securities, the Fed has shoved $3 trillion into the U.S. banking system. One might expect that to cause inflation, right? That's what we're taught in econ class. But here's the thing.
This is $3 trillion that never left the building.
Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Wells Capital Management. So the Fed handed over all this money to the banks, hoping they would lend it out. But the banks aren't doing much with it.
Most of it hasn't even touched the economy. They're being held as excess reserves at the Federal Reserve.
Excess reserves are sort of like savings accounts for banks at the Fed. Matthew Slaughter is with Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. So why are banks holding on to the money?
It is a combination of some banks are still reluctant to make more loans. And some of it is the businesses and families that used to come to the banks for more loans at those times, they're not coming to demand the loan.
People aren't confident the economy will pick up quickly. But that's today. What about tomorrow? What happens if the banks decide to start lending all that money they have lying around?
The big challenge will be to reduce this mountain of bank reserves at just the right pace, given what the economy is doing.
Alan Blinder is a Princeton economist. He says if those reserves finally do flood the economy, the Fed will have to take money out of circulation.
So the Fed is going to have to make judgment calls about where it wants to take its chances.
If it reduces the money supply too fast, it might stunt the economy. If it goes too slow, it could let inflation sweep in.
And that's going to be a really critical set of choices for the Fed.
But not today. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Things could change again, of course, but as of now, Janet Yellen is likely to be the next chair of the Federal Reserve, indeed the Fed's first chairwoman. Yellen has a lot of experience at the Fed. She's gotten endorsements from leading economists, from Democratic politicians and progressive groups, but she only seems to have risen to the top of President Obama's list by process of elimination. So what in the world was wrong with Janet Yellen in the president's eyes? Marketplace's Mark Garrison looks into that.
How Yellen fell behind Summers in this contest critical to monetary policy had practically nothing to do with monetary policy. Go ahead. Just try asking a former Fed economist like Ann Owen.
That sounds more like a political question. I mean, honestly, I'm not sure if I'm the right person to answer that question.
The president and his top advisors just didn't know Yellen and felt comfortable with someone they did, Summers. It was mostly politics, though not all. The new Fed chair will have to unwind the stimulus. ITG chief economist Steve Blitz points out that Summers fans thought he'd do a better job than a Fed insider.
The more substantive point that people make about Yellen is this concern that she will not be quick enough to, quote-unquote, take the punch bowl from the party.
The White House wanted the guy they knew. The guy they knew. And that's where things got ugly. Larry Summers fans went after Yellen in the press, questioning not so much her credentials, but whether she was aggressive or tough enough, and whether she had enough gravitas. Leadership consultant Jill Flynn has heard that line before.
The word gravitas is a code word for male leader as opposed to female leader.
The attacks on Yellen brought gender politics into the mix and took the debate even further from the actual work of the Fed chair. But if she does get the job, Columbia Business School professor Catherine Phillips says the drama will be irrelevant.
I absolutely believe none of it matters because when she gets in there and she has the authority of the position that she will be in, she will be the only one in that position and people will have to live with it.
If, of course, this bizarre hiring process finally ends with Janet Yellen as Fed chair. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
A good day on Wall Street today as traders await the outcome of that Fed meeting. Details when we do the numbers. More data now. The U.S. Census Bureau released numbers on median income. More on that in a minute. What you need to know is that it stayed the same. A lot of people had hoped those numbers would increase as we come out of a recession, but they haven't, which is not great news for the middle class. But if you talk to some economists, they'd say there is no economic rule that America has to have the kind of middle class it had in the past. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noelle King reports.
Median is a statistical term. If you make the median income, half the population earns more than you do and half earns less. You're in the middle of the middle. Because of all those middles, sometimes we equate median earners with middle class. But middle class isn't statistical. It's an idea. Gordon Green is a partner at Centure Research, a data consulting firm.
There's no commonly accepted definition of the middle class. There are different things that have been proposed, but we haven't really settled on one yet.
But a lot of ordinary people feel like they know what it means to be middle class. You're not wealthy, but you're not poor. You can afford a home. You're comfortable. For decades, the American economy created lots of those middle-class jobs. But MIT economist Darren Acemoglu says a lot of the jobs being created these days aren't getting people into the middle class.
We have an economy that does not produce as many semi-skilled occupations of the sort that we saw in the 50s and the 60s. Instead, we have many more service occupations and many more lower-pay occupations.
Look, no one wants to go back to the 50s. And even if, say, middle-class manufacturing jobs have gone away, other middle-class jobs will replace them, right? It's not like the American middle class can vanish.
There is no economic law that such a middle class has to exist, or it will always be populated by millions of people.
Wait, let me make sure I heard that right.
There is no economic law that such a middle class has to exist.
Okay, so what would America look like without a traditional comfortable middle class?
Well, I think it's very difficult to do science fiction about economics.
For an economist, it probably is. Maybe this is a job for a science fiction writer who works with dark ideas.
There's a kind of a joke amongst young adult authors that we have to kill off all the parents in our books.
That's Jennifer Albin, author of The Cruel Trilogy, young adult dystopian novels. When I asked her to write me a version of America where all the middle class jobs have gone away, Jennifer started thinking about her daughter, Sydney, who is three. She imagined Sydney 25 years in the future.
2038. The car was packed tighter than a sardine can. Sydney fought her way into a wall of people not bothering to sit.
In a world where people fight for work.
She dreaded seeing the elderly on their way to another job or a different grandchild's couch. Their appearance always sparked a volatile mix of emotions. There was disgust. Disgust with the elderly for taking a job from someone like her who needed it so badly.
There's no retirement in Jennifer's version of the future. No one can afford it. The elite have walled themselves off, but ordinary people crowd into cities looking for work. They live six to an apartment. They sleep in shifts.
Last shift hadn't made the bed, but she was too tired to care. Sydney shifted onto her side, away from the light, and tried to turn off the thoughts competing for her attention. She wanted to sleep before the water came back on, before it was time to get back to her first job.
Back in the real world, MIT's Darren Acemoglu may not do science fiction, but he can envision one way to help rebuild the middle class. What if all the people catering to the uber wealthy made better, maybe even middle class, wages?
Think about it this way. Today, if you think of gardening, that's a relatively low pay occupation. But gardening can morph into landscaping that pays much higher wages than currently gardening does.
Of course, there's no guarantee that will happen. Just as there's no guarantee that the middle class will always be the middle class as we know it. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Whether your income's at the median or far from it, try out our new Income Upshot game at marketplace.org. You put in your income, it'll tell you how people who make what you make live, work, and play. Are you more likely to drive a Dodge Dart or a Mercedes? Do you tend to sip suds or Chardonnay? And yes, are you a dog person or a cat person? The game is called Income Upshot, and it's at marketplace.org. car is still a novelty, to me at least. That's because there aren't a whole lot of them on the road. There's the Tesla S, which is relatively expensive. The base price is $62,400. There's the Nissan Leaf, which is less expensive, but the farthest it can go is 75 miles on one charge. General Motors thinks it has the answer. The company announced it's working on a vehicle that'll be able to go 200 miles, that'll cost about $30,000. No word on when that car will be available, but when it is, will GM have better luck than Tesla and Nissan getting Americans to buy it? Sasha Strauss is a consultant who teaches branding at UCLA and USC. Hey, Sasha, it's good to talk to you.
Always an honor, David.
So I want to assume that you drove into the studio today, and I wanted to ask if you yourself own an electric car.
Oh, no. Here I am on the radio. I do not drive an electric car. I haven't made the leap yet, but I'm next in line, we'll say.
And what would make you buy an electric car? What are you waiting for?
That's the right question, is that we're all waiting for just that right trigger, right? So, for example, GM, with its announcement of this 200-mile car, they're saying the reason why you haven't bought into the electric car, the hybrid car market yet, is because you have range anxiety. You're too concerned you're not going to meet that distance. Well, I always drive SUVs, so I've been waiting for the perfect car that I can take snowboarding but also drive family around.
Let me ask you about these specs, a car that's able to go 200 miles on a single charge for about $30,000. Why are those specs so important?
They're important because the consumer doesn't know how to rationalize their car buying behavior. They think that they're buying the car because it's well-built or German-engineered, but in the end, it's really about its integration into their lifestyle. So the challenge has always been, I don't drive 200 miles at a time, ever, but once a year, there's that family trip that I want to take. Oh no, the car can't do that. Well, then it's not right for my lifestyle.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I know with my car that uses gas that if I wanted to light out of here this afternoon, drive across the country, I could.
You could.
Knowing pretty well that there'd be gas stations all along the way. I don't feel that way about charging stations for an electric car.
That's exactly the anxiety that everyone is feeling here, is that car equals freedom. We all remember when we got our license at 16, and sure, it really didn't even matter that it was mom's minivan, had wood paneling, you know. It was that freedom, right? Well, as soon as the car becomes a constraint on that freedom, even if it's 1% of the time, that becomes a draw on us, and we don't want that type of distraction. Our lives are too active. We've got too many goals to meet.
We have had electric cars for a number of years now. We've dreamt of electric cars for many longer than that. Why has this proven so hard? Why has it been so hard to get a car that's both relatively inexpensive and can go about 200 miles?
We have. We've had electric cars for more than 100 years, but we've always had this challenge that batteries are toxic, filled with acid. They're hard to manufacture, hard to maintain, hard to sustain in cold weather, warm weather. And so we're only getting into the science of being able to manage them effectively. And that's really where Tesla has been most innovative.
Cost is still such a big issue here. If I want to be green, or if I want to come across as green, I can maybe carry a Nalgene bottle full of water, or I can bring reusable bags to the grocery store. But to buy a green car is still something that could be seen as prohibitively expensive. How does an automaker get around that and convince me that this is worth doing?
Once you cross, let's say, the $30,000 threshold of price in automobiles, it becomes less about the functional value of the vehicle, let's say a pickup truck, and more about what it says about you in your professional or social roles. So you can buy a $60,000 pickup truck with no new function, just plush leather and Harley Davidson emblazoned across the side of the truck. And what that basically does is says, yes, I functionally need the utility of this vehicle, but in the grand scheme of things, it also matters how I feel about myself when I get in the morning. And that emotional sensation has not trickled into the electric car sector yet. Since this is a disruptive innovation, this is a whole new type of car. In fact, I would analogize it to the Model T. It's going to take time for the audience to appreciate that this really is a whole new paradigm. This is not just the next car.
Sasha Strauss is a branding expert at Innovation Protocol in Los Angeles. Sasha, thank you very much.
An honor again, David. Thank you.
Coming up, the NFL says Super Bowl ticket prices might go up to sideline ticket brokers like StubHub.
I don't see a backlash. I think the typical NFL fan, they're not going to go anyhow. They're going to watch it on TV.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average continued its climb back, gaining 34 points, 0.2% to finish at 15,529. The NASDAQ added 27 points, 0.75%, closing at 3,745. And the S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.4%, ending at 1,704. Microsoft has at last decided on the best way to invest its pile of cash. In Microsoft, the aging software giant announced it would buy back $40 billion of its shares. That move usually doesn't have much effect on share price, but it does raise profits per share. Microsoft rose 0.4%. European markets fell. Britain's FTSE was off 0.8%. Germany's DAX lost 0.2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for August. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on reevaluating the effectiveness of federal mandatory minimum sentences. And if you've ever gone out in public without your face on, you know how dangerous it can feel. On September 18, 1983, the band Kiss made an appearance on MTV without makeup. A first for the guys. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. U.S. GDP growth has been hovering around 2.5%. In China, it's a little more than three times as much. It's at 7.6%, which sounds pretty good by comparison. But that number has the Chinese worried. After years of double-digit growth, China's economy is slowing down. It's now in danger of falling short of the government's annual target. What's this look like on the ground? Well, Rob Schmitz, Marketplace's China correspondent, joins us to talk about that. He's in our studio in Shanghai. Hey there, Rob.
Hey, David. How you doing?
So what are people telling you about this slowdown when you're walking around on the street? Are people talking about it?
Yeah, they are. And they're talking about how much pressure various things in the economy is having on them, not only for their jobs, but also for buying things. As you know, David, for the past year, I've profiled people who make their livings on a single street in Shanghai called Changlelu in Chinese.
So that's the street of eternal happiness.
That's correct. I go back to check in with folks from time to time and see how they're doing. And lately, I've been hearing sort of tales of gloom and doom. One guy I know, Ma Guoqiang, has had a men's clothing shop on the street for 10 years. And he told me business has never been this bad. So Mao's saying here that the wholesale price of the clothes he buys has gone up, and that's because the price of the raw materials has gone up, as well as cost of labor in China. To make matters worse, he says his customers aren't spending as much as they used to, so that means he's charging less to try to get his customers to buy, which for him means less profit.
Okay, so on this street of eternal happiness, I'm actually going to rename it. I'm going to say the Avenue of Eternal Anxiety. How about that?
Sure.
On the Avenue of Eternal Anxiety, sort of what other signs of anxiety do you see? Is this happening, you know, with other business owners and other shops?
It is, and it's not just shops. You know, we're seeing the entire economy sort of slow down for a slower landing here. And you know, I was just recently on a trip to the city of Wenzhou, which is the richest city of the richest province of China. Wenzhou is famous because it was the first place that China allowed a private market to really flourish. And I spent a day on a street that was named Shoe Street, which is a bunch of shoe factories, interviewing factory owner after factory owner. All of them had the same story. They said, you know, this is very difficult for us right now because not only do we have a slowing down economy in China, but we've got a slower economy not only in the United States that really hasn't picked up that much yet, but also in Europe. And so I think all of these global ripples are really having a big impact on China.
Are you getting any sort of sense from people on the streets, from economists, of how long this is going to last? Any sort of indication of how much longer this is going to go on?
It's hard to know. You know, in the last couple of months, we've had a lot of numbers that have gone up, right? And so we've had exports, industrial output, things like that. And they've looked really strong. But one of the most important economic numbers for China's future that isn't going up is the household income. Growth in urban household income in China fell by more than 3% in the past year. That is not a good sign. President Xi Jinping came into power earlier this year promising economic reforms that would shift China's economic growth model from one dependent on building things and exporting things to a model closer to that of the U.S., which is more dependent on consumption for economic growth. But if people are making less money than they were last year, and China is still a relatively poor country, then they're not going to be going out and buying more stuff. And the business owners who sell that stuff, like my friend Mr. Mao, who we were talking about, won't be selling more of it. And the same goes for the slew of U.S. retailers who are placing their bets on this rising consumer class in China for their future growth.
And they haven't given up on that yet.
Not yet. Not yet, though.
Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz joining us online from Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, David.
You can hear all the stories in Rob's series, The Street of Eternal Happiness, online. There are pictures, an interactive map, and everywhere Rob's gone. Check it out, marketplace.org. Maybe you've seen one of those new ads for The Gap with someone who looks a lot like the late George Harrison. Yeah, well, it turns out that's Harrison's son, Danny, and he's part of the clothing retailer's new Back to Blue advertising campaign. Gap has returned to TV after a four-year hiatus. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains why.
The Gap's been around since 1969, so you can imagine it's gone through an identity crisis or two. Its first store sold Levi's and vinyl records. Since then, it's been everything from preppy cotton sweaters to tangerine-colored jeans. And their TV ads, everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to LL Cool J.
I know you like your outfit stylist, any other line, but the Gap is childish. Everybody working there is a personal stylist.
Now the Gap is using the not very famous children of very famous boomers, like Billy Joel, singing their dad's songs.
When I saw the commercials, made me feel quite old.
That's Wendy Liebman. She's CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. She says the Gap's making a turnaround partly because of some bare knuckles cost-cutting and clothes that are less boring, like fitness apparel. Because frankly, anybody can sell jeans these days.
You know, Cheap and Cheerful, which is H&M, Forever 21, Uniqlo, Joe Fresh. You've got the big box Targets and Walmarts of this world.
Not to mention Levi's, whose new TV campaign kicks the Gap's butt. At least Liebman thinks so. But Kevin Koop at MorningNewsBeat.com says he'll take Billy Joel and George Harrison's kids anytime.
Because they're going to appeal not just necessarily to kids, but quite frankly, they're also going to appeal to the parents who often are buying those kids' clothes.
And in this economy, some of those kids could be somebody as old as Danny Harrison. He's 35.
I love you more than ever, girl, I do.
I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
If you've dreamed of watching the Super Bowl in person, of getting some good seats next year at MetLife Stadium in the Meadowlands, well, so much for that. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal, those tickets could be more out of reach than ever. The NFL is considering a plan to more than double the price of some seats. And as Marketplace's Queena Kim reports, that could put the broke in ticket brokers.
Back when tickets were scalped in front of stadiums, it was hard to know how much they went for. Well, reselling has moved online to brokers like StubHub. And that means anyone can see just how much more fans are willing to pay. Well, the NFL has crunched the numbers and figured out that the resellers are making bank. George Daly is a professor at Georgetown University's Business School.
The NFL feels that the profit should accrue to them rather than to ticket brokers.
The biggest payoff comes from the best seats. The word is that club-level seats, which were about $1,200 last year, will more than double to around $2,600 this year. Daly says, sure, the brokers can jack up the prices even more, but probably not a whole lot. And what about the fans?
I don't see a backlash. I think the typical NFL fan, they're not going to go anyhow. They're going to watch it on TV.
Tom Regan is a sports economist at the University of South Carolina. He says that average fans buy about a third of the seats, and the NFL is expected to lower the price on those by about $100. The primo tickets typically go to bigwigs and corporate sponsors. And there are plenty of those in New York and New Jersey where the game's being held. Michael Leeds teaches sports economics at Temple University.
We're talking about the vice president for marketing for J.P. Morgan walking with a picket sign. I don't think that's going to happen.
But Leeds says what could happen is empty seats.
You know, this is their showcase. They want to show that the Super Bowl is this wildly popular event, and empty seats undercuts that.
He says empty seats won't stop the NFL from pulling in a lot more money, but it might leave advertisers, the other cash cow, wondering where'd all the fans go. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today. For decades now, Butterball, the North Carolina-based meat manufacturer, has had what it calls the Turkey Talk Line. It's a toll-free number that's up and running in November and December. And every year, tens of thousands of Americans call in to talk to one of 50 professionally trained, college-educated home economists and nutritionists, all of whom have been women. This year, that'll change. The company is hiring its first male spokesman. The only requirement, Butterball says, you have to want to help people. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 34 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ added 27 points, 0.75%. And the S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.3%. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Jolie Myers are producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.